Welcome to the 22nd episode of Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, and this is your longest continuously running tech podcast hosted by a VC with his entrepreneur friends. And thanks, everyone, for joining. So what you're going to hear on this episode is another installation of the crypto use case debate. We are not going to do this every episode. I promise we're running to the end of this, but this is a conversation that Zach Weinberg and I had with Sean McGuire from Sequoia, and we went into a bunch of the different use cases. And so definitely an interesting conversation. And then on the back half of the episode, you're going to hear a conversation I had with my friend Andrew Parker, who's the CEO of a company called Papa. We are not investors in the business. I just happen to think Andrew's a funny guy. He's raised money from SoftBank. He is sitting in the intersection of a lot of interesting trends in the healthcare market and health insurance. And so we go into a bunch of that stuff and a really fun conversation. So I guess a little programming note as well. Zach at this point has become a recurring character. He has committed to do that going forward, and so I'm not exactly sure what form factor this whole thing's going to take. We've obviously evolved quite a bit since we got going, but really appreciate everyone bearing with us and as we kind of figure this out, and excited to have Zach even more on board going forward, and so excited for you to hear the conversation that we've had with Sean, and then the one with Andrew Parker as well here now. How are we doing today, guys?
I didn't realize you're so handsome, Logan. I mean, I haven't watched your podcast, so I'm very impressed.
Normally, I have to pay people to say nice things about me.
But you got the hat on, so maybe you're covering up a bald spot or something.
Yeah, you know, people always.
No, it's actually pretty nice hair you got.
Yeah, you know, I actually do have I've always had a widow's peak as a child, or even when I was young, and now people will be like, "Your hair is receding," and I'm like, "No, I'm just." That's the way it looks. That's the way I am. So, no. Well, I appreciate the compliments.
What am I, chop liver, Sean? Like, I just sit here. We make fun
you're,
of love.
You're like a 8 out of 10. Logan's a 9 out of 10.
I appreciate that. Zach, I will say you have far more views and screen time on Twitter and the internet of late than I do. So it doesn't surprise me. I think Sean's probably had your clips of you.
Zach, you just never smile. Like the only time I see a smile is like just a little smirk when you're getting those Web3 memes out there. You know, like
I mostly just smirk. Yeah, mostly angry all day. Like, I just am pissed, you know, from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. That's basically it.
It did tell me you stop at night. That's, I figured it would just go right on through. It would be 24 hours a day.
No, 8 o'clock, you know, kicks in and I get very happy for about 45 minutes and that's about it.
So, Sean, thanks for doing this. So I think we're going to, let's keep this broader than just crypto. I would love to kind of touch on, I don't know, your background and getting into venture, working at Sequoia, markets, all that stuff. And then maybe the tail end, we can do crypto as well, because I have a feeling that would derail the conversation if we tried to do it in the reverse order. But so you're in, you're nice enough to do this. It's late in London. So you're hanging out over there this summer?
Yeah, so we opened a London office 2 years ago. We hired an amazing, badass woman, Luciana Alexandru, to join the team, and hired a couple more people kind of that were newer to venture capital. They're incredibly talented, George Knotts and a couple others, and Matt Miller moved over. But we've been trying to get people to spend time out here, you know, and just explore the ecosystem, build cultural ties, all that. And so spending the summer in London, it's pretty nice.
Yeah, it's impressive you guys have been able to scale and grow to the extent you have. You're spending all summer over there. Maybe walk us through your path into venture and, yeah, how you ended up at Sequoia, and then we can go from there.
This is a long story. I'll do my best to keep it brief. I'm from Southern California. I was obsessed with computers as a kid. I built my first computer when I was 7. Just absolutely grew up on the internet. I went to public school. I absolutely hated it. I got renamed to Joel my second day of 7th grade.
You got renamed to Joel just by like assholes in school, just decided
it was
Joel.
Totally fluke thing, and I know the guys afterwards, but so there's my second day of 7th grade, a 10th grader is standing on a planter, and I'm walking through a sea of people. Because my school is 7th through 12th grade, and so I was like prepubescent, you know, it's like that's when you go through puberty. And he just pointed at me through a sea of people and he said, "You." I'm like, "Me?" He's like, "Your new name is Joel." And I was just like, what? And I just kept walking. But there's this, the Terramina family. There were five kids or four kids in the school. And he had a brother in my class. And he told all of his friends that they should like go to my teachers and tell my teachers that I prefer to be called Joel. So what they went to all my teachers, they told them I prefer to be called Joel. I showed up at like one of these classes. They didn't call my name on the roll call. This is back when there's paper roll calls. It's like, you know, this is, we're getting back there. And they don't call my name. I go up to the teacher. I'm like, hey, you didn't call my name. They're looking there. And I see my name and Sean is crossed out and it says Joel. I'm like, no. My name's not Joel. It's Sean. It's Sean McGuire. And a kid yells out from the back of the class, says, my name's not Joel. It's Sean McGuire. And then everyone laughed, and I was like, what is happening?
I picture, like, the O'Doyle family from Billy Madison, like, yelling at you.
That is exactly what happened. And so it just kicked off a whole cascade of, like, I would get in fights. Like, I just said, you're all fucking morons. Like, I would go protect when they would try to bully other kids. Like, I would go get in fights to protect these kids. Like, I just made it my duty to, like, fight these kids. And it made me super disillusioned with school. I was pretty gifted in math and I had a teacher give me a zero on an algebra 2 test because I didn't show any work. And I told the teacher, like, I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, just ask me any question you want. They're like, no, sorry, you get a zero. And I went to the principal. The principal wouldn't change the grade. And so I just stopped going to school and basically just stayed home and did my own thing. I got an F in that algebra 2 class, which, you know, I have a PhD maths from Caltech. And I think it was a pretty good, pretty proud of that. But so anyways, I just didn't really go to school, left early by taking this thing called the California High School Proficiency Exam, went to community college. But this is an incredibly important phase of my life because I had a realization that, like, you don't learn in school. Like, in school, there's insane context switching. You know, if you're trying to learn how to build a computer, you don't do it by having an hour to build it and then switching to English class for an hour and then history class for an hour. Like, the way you actually learn to do something like that is having 4 days straight where you're just obsessed in a room trying to make it work. And so I basically was able to unplug myself from the matrix, which was very freeing and turned out to be amazing for me. And it also just gave me an alternative perspective my whole life. And I've kind of done things different than everyone else my whole life. And just like some of the other things.
Was the life goal to become a Sequoia partner so that you could call out the family you just referenced publicly on our podcast?
Absolutely not. I thought I'd be a math professor, like, or a physics professor. That's what I thought for a very long time. And when I was doing my PhD, I got recruited to work on a DARPA project.
Hey, I'm sorry. So you went to community college and then from there,
I went to USC for 2 years. I got a bachelor's in math. Then I went to Stanford, started grad school in machine learning, and then moved to Caltech to do a PhD in physics.
And so then the DARPA thing is happening while you're at Caltech. Yeah, got it. And so you went from the community college to USC, that old pipeline, community college.
That is a very common pipeline. I did it kind of with a different path. But yeah, very, very common path.
So now DARPA's recruiting you.
I mean, yeah, I was recruited for the football team. Varsity.
Yeah, exactly. The side door at USC, as we know all too well. Yeah.
The side door, you know, absolutely is the only way I could get in.
So now you're 24, Caltech PhD, yeah. And I assume more focused on school than you were when the O'Doyles were pushing Joel around. But
yeah, I mean, like at Stanford, I had over a 4.0. I was pretty motivated. I had over a 4.0, you know. I was taking more than the max number of classes, call it 8 classes a quarter or something like that, you know, like taking all the hardest graduate classes. Like, I had a chip on my shoulder and I think that's really healthy. But there's something that's very important in between there that I didn't say, which is I basically took a year and traveled around the world. And so I've been to about 95 countries. Living.
Sean, this feels like your dating profile here.
Oh yeah. Part of why I dropped that in there is it's actually important for the crypto story.
I enjoy travel, extensive math background.
Thinking about black holes and, you know, fancy wines.
You went to go work at DARPA, right?
Yeah. So I got recruited for this pretty crazy project at DARPA. It was related to the war in Afghanistan. basically it was about 10 of us that were given pretty much unprecedented access to the DoD. And this was 2010 to 2012. It was an inflection point, you know, in machine learning, data science. Like, it was the beginning of big data. And we had a really broad mandate to kind of work on basically whatever we wanted, whatever we thought would be the highest impact. It was very experimental. And, you know, I spent 4 months in Afghanistan as part of that. We did insane stuff. I mean, like, I think work we did made the front page of the New York Times at least 5 times.
And so you start from a just market standpoint. I would love to hear how you ended up. So you were security by background and math, or your PhD was in what?
I was a hacker as a kid. And so I had a lot of computer experience. And my PhD was in black holes. Like, what happened inside black holes, you know? Quantum gravity, the same kind of the continuation of the questions that Stephen Hawking originally asked that made him extremely famous. Like, what happens inside a black hole?
Got it. And so I want to get to how you ended up in crypto, but maybe just start with how. So you ended up investing in some stuff related to enterprise, but ultimately kind of made your way into crypto. What was the intrigue that that you had that sort of drew you in?
So I've been in crypto for a very long time, basically since the beginning, through many different paths. And crypto in the beginning was Bitcoin. The first is that I was doing my PhD when the Satoshi white paper came out. And, you know, your job as a PhD student is just to read papers. Like, that's what you do. And the Satoshi paper was one of the most interesting kind of math, computer science papers of that vintage. And so pretty much everyone around me, like, we all kind of read the paper and talked about it and didn't know what to make of it, but just thought there was some interesting ideas in there. I didn't buy any Bitcoin at that point, but I got exposed to it and thought a lot about it. And then when I joined the DoD, it was a huge conversation topic. Like, we would, you know, at DARPA in 2010, I was in the information innovation office, a very small thing. There may be 20 people on my floor, and it was some of the most brilliant people in the world, like Mudge, Peter Zacko, one of the most famous hackers of all time, started The Loft, and, you know, this guy Dan Roelker, who, funny enough, is like the VP engine at OpenSea now, but he was running software at SpaceX before, and the people I was working with directly on this program, he became my co-founders, you know, Matt, Tim, Joe Meyerowitz, etc. And so we would talk about Bitcoin all the time. It was just a fascinating thing. We would talk about what you can do with it and what it, you know, ramifications for war, for terrorist financing, things like that. And then with my company, we actually used Bitcoin all the way back in the very beginning, like in 2013. So the way we would figure out companies' networks is we would basically scan the entire internet. So we would send, like, we literally wanted to know, our first step was to know every single device on IPv4, every single device on the public internet. And the way we would do that is we basically had servers all over the world that would send crazy number of packets to every IP address. And you had to send, we'd send like thousands of packets to each IP address because some of them would get dropped. But most importantly, like, you have every device, if you send the right message, like the right string, like, who are you or what are you device, or are you a Cisco, whatever type of router? Like, there's always a diagnostic message you can send where it will then say, I am this. And so we wrote all these packets. And when you're sending that number of packets, people will blacklist you. Like, a good sysadmin will realize, like, oh, these are these freaking morons from, you know, California that keep scanning us. Like, we're going to blacklist all of their IPs. And there were a few like server farms in Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia where you could pay them anonymously using Bitcoin and they would run computation jobs for you and then send traffic. And so in 2013, we actually started to use Bitcoin for that purpose. And then maybe 2 years later, we deprecated that because we had enough. We like set up our own infrastructure all over the place. But this is very important because if people knew that it was us sending the traffic, we would get blacklisted. And so anyways, like, for what it's worth, it's a kind of crazy story. We I think it was like $15,000 worth of Bitcoin when we stopped that program that we had in a wallet and we forgot about it. And in December 2017, when the price ran up to, you know, just under 20K, we had to have an emergency board meeting because like that Bitcoin was worth almost our revenue for the year. And so we had to figure out, what do we do with it? Do we distribute it? Do we sell it and keep it on the balance sheet? Like, what do we do with it?
I thought you had paid it out already. This is the Bitcoin you had left, or the Bitcoin,
we had paid it? We had probably $15,000 worth of Bitcoin in 2015 dollars that became worth, you know, roughly $5 million US.
When you were paying these other groups in Bitcoin, was it like individuals or were they companies or what was the, who were the groups?
The groups were like kind of very janky data centers is the way I would describe it. And you know, they'd have websites. Like, I don't know the legal structure behind it. It was like, there's a website, you send Bitcoin to a wallet, and then they would send packets on your behalf.
Got it. Do you validate that, like, they're not on the terrorist watch list or KYC stuff for the vendor, or you just kind of ignore the who are we paying question?
I mean, we were paying them order hundreds of dollars. And I mean, Zach, I know what you're trying to do. Like, you're trying to catch me, but I think that
I'm honestly not trying to catch you. I just, anytime I hear like I'm paying some third party in Bitcoin, my first question goes, do you know who they are? You know, are we like legally paying this group that we're, you know,
I mean,
sending
what is worth, I've been working in terrorist financing for years before that. And I'm pretty sure we were not paying terrorists. I'm pretty sure we were paying like Ukrainians that were really smart and needed to make a living. And they found a niche business.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right. That would make sense.
I can't trace all the way to the bottom, but the dollars we were paying was on the order of hundreds of dollars per month at the time. Literally just to send packets.
It was like an irrelevant amount of money that didn't make, I totally get it.
Yeah. And we weren't paying them enough money to where they were going to go like use our $200 a month to go do something really
cool. Yeah. I get it.
But maybe they'd buy some McDonald's hamburgers when McDonald's was still in the area.
Yeah.
And Zach, I respect you a ton. So I have no idea. Like, I don't know your views on crypto. Like, maybe you absolutely hate all of crypto, or maybe like it's only Web3 or it's people shilling things that are clearly like get rich quick schemes. Like, I don't know where you are on the spectrum, but like for me, my wife's family from Iran, they're Persian Jews. In 1979, they tried to kill both of my wife's grandfathers and they basically had to flee the country. One was luckily on vacation to Israel, but they lost all of their assets, all of their bank deposits, their real estate, etc. The other grandfather tried to stay, the rest of the family left, but he stayed to try to get money out. He got thrown in prison. He was there for 9 months and then was able to escape, ride on horseback from Tehran to Istanbul. But they lost everything. Even today with Bitcoin, like if you have Bitcoin and you put it in a wallet and you own that wallet with remembering 24 words, you can go anywhere in the world. And as long as you have your mind and like, you know, you've not been put in prison or whatever, you're mobile, like no one can steal that Bitcoin. And that alone, like even that to me was pretty revolutionary. And that's something I really believe in. And I'm happy to talk about like terrorist applications or all sorts of things that are major, or, you know, North Korea trying to skirt, you know, currency controls. And like, I'm happy to talk about all that. But just that core application is what motivated me the most. And it's something that with my family background and also my experience of backpacking in 95 countries and seeing the way a lot of people live, I just can't even get to tell you how important that application is to me. That's really the core thing I believe in.
Yeah, that one is always interesting to me because I feel like, obviously, I kind of in a way fundamentally agree. Like, that's an important, I mean, being Jewish myself, right? Like, talk about persecuted pretty much everywhere you go in history.
I'm Jewish as well, for its worth. I'm just a stealth Jew.
Sean McGuire, you're hiding it well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I could, the amount of hiding I could possibly do with the last name Weinberg, the face like this. And if I turn to the side, the nose like that, it's like not going to work. My, I actually think that use case has always been interesting because people, I think, tend to take this idea of like, I can escape with my money, which I want to talk about, like logistically how that works, and then conflate it with this like broader, almost idealistic state of I can use a non-local currency, like a digital version, let's call it Bitcoin for a second, but it could be anything on a day-to-day basis, which I think is very much not true. The first one I think is an interesting case of like, all right, there's this like 48-hour, 72-hour window where theoretically like I want to escape, right? And step one is I have to get as many of my assets as possible into Bitcoin or some alternative, right? I have to get into Ethereum, which I guess my first question in all this is always just like, how? How do you get your local? Yeah. You see where I'm going with this? Like, how do you get your money into Bitcoin? Assuming you haven't done it consistently up front. If you've done it consistently up front and you have savings and you've actually hadn't, you know, you needed to, you know, you had the Bitcoin already. I understand that you don't have to do anything. Yeah. Where do you get the main set of dollars? Like, how do you get it in?
Yeah. So first of all, I would hope that some people have been getting it in consistently before, similar to how a lot of people store gold and other kind of precious metals and things for this downside case. Second of all, just as a personal anecdote, like this is exactly what happened to my wife's family. Like my wife's grandfather, the one that stayed, he actually loaded like all of their jewelry and valuables into three trunks. And he tried to smuggle all three trunks out of the country in different methods.
Yeah, like the classic escape mechanism is like you buy diamonds with local currency and you kind of like hide the diamonds. Basically.
And obviously all three were intercepted. And so none of the three trunks made it out. But there was this 48-hour period of like trying to get selling all their assets, you know, trying to, you know, at 50 cents on the dollar, putting it in, you know, trunks of valuables, sending it out, hoping they'd make it out, and they didn't make it. But that is actually, I think, exactly what would happen here. Like, let's say, hypothetically, you live in a country where, like, let's say you're a Persian Jew, and you know there were 200,000 of them in Tehran at the time, and in a population of, I don't know the population of Iran at the time, but call it 20 million, to call it 1%. Let's say that everyone in Iran on average had 1% of their net worth in Bitcoin. You're 1% of the population. That's a lot of Bitcoin that's laid in the country. If you go and just start peer to peer in 48 hours. For 50 cents on the dollar, instead of exchanging for, you know, your valuables for diamonds, like literally giving the title to your real estate or, you know, giving a car or whatever, instead of exchanging that for gold or diamonds, if you're exchanging it for crypto keys where people are literally...
Like I go to you and I say, here's my car. Yeah. Hopefully you have some savings, which, as you know, most people don't in these countries as a function of the fact that it is like an autocratic asshole in the top of it. Right.
That's not true though. People have savings, just not as much relative to other places. And Iran in 1979 was actually a very prosperous place.
Totally. No. I agree. That's like an interesting use case going back to Iran, but.
And I'm just saying, so would you rather, like quite literally, if you're in that scenario today, would you rather try to convert your assets into, say, diamonds and gold and precious metals that you can try to, and maybe some dollars that you can try to smuggle out. We have to ship it in a trunk and people can intercept it at the border. Yep. Or would you rather get it all in a crypto wallet where all you have to do is remember a 24-word password?
I mean, my concern, if I were in this situation, and thank God I am not, is that at a certain point, owning crypto in many of these places, if people are consistently escaping, will be illegal. By decree, right? In many cases, it probably already is getting close to that. And then I've got to go and convert my physical assets, house, whatever, into crypto, which means I've got to go to other people, locals, probably, that I know, or maybe kind of pseudo know, because no one individual has enough savings to like really match. So I've got to go to like a bunch of people to do this. And then each one of them...
Isn't that exactly what was happening in this example, but instead of...
Yeah, totally. No. I agree.
And this is literally someone that was on the kill list that was going to their Muslim friends but they're their friend. And so it's just,
I'm not suggesting either of these are good situations, to be very clear, but like each one of those is now a digital transaction that is recorded and monitored by the local government because it is like definitionally recorded.
How is it recorded? Like, it's recorded if you're using Coinbase or centralized exchange. It's not recorded if you have your crypto in a wallet that they don't know about.
But like, you think there's going to be hundreds or thousands of people in these countries where Bitcoin is illegal that have unknowable wallets that the government doesn't just like show up and check?
I'm not saying there'll be hundreds or thousands, but I'm saying Bitcoin is the first way to actually accomplish the goal I'm setting out.
And no, I just think of it as like the risk I introduce by going to, and let's just call it 100. I don't, it doesn't matter, but I have to go to like 100 unique individuals.
You don't have to go to 100 people. And just like, I mean, there's so many, like, you know, if everyone on average has 1% of their net worth, if there's one person that's really wealthy, that right. like maybe you go to one person, like,
in, right. And then that person sends me
two people.
And that person sends me Bitcoin, right? And then a bunch of other people do. And I have to hope. And again, this is unfortunate. I'm not suggesting. Okay, I have to hope. Also, hold on. I have to hope.
But also, we're getting in the weeds now because.
Well, but that's how this is actually how it happens for somebody, right? Because they have to get the Bitcoin to be able to escape.
But Zach, if you go all the way back to the beginning, you had made a premise that if you don't have Bitcoin to begin with. And
no, and I'm suggesting even if they do, let's say they do, I'm going to give you the assumption that some people could, you know.
No. I'm saying, let's say you as the individual, let's say you as Zach, the Jew in
Iran,
or wherever in the world, let's say that you're already holding 20% of your net worth in a Bitcoin wallet where you have the key to it, then you can now leave the country.
By the way, illegal for me to do that, to be very clear, right? Like in these situations, that would probably be illegal for me to own.
I mean, it was illegal to be Jewish in a lot of places in the world. Like, you can't help it. And it's like,
well, I mean, I definitely can't help being Jewish. I can help holding Bitcoins. Those are not the same things. But like, my point is more this is a use case. This is a use case that can work. This is
Zach in Nazi Germany, it was illegal. So my family were German Jews and they left in the 1800s. It was illegal to get married. If you didn't get permission from the local council, only as a Jew, you had to pay a tax every time you crossed between.
No, look, I understand. Like, you can't persecute. No, the laws are definitionally not fair. I think it's a great. I do. I really do. I really think it's a great thing for the very small subset of people during the window in time in which they are trying to escape. Because it's like a one-time thing, hopefully, per person that happens not on a consistent basis, happens infrequently, right? I believe it is a good thing that they have an alternative to trying to buy diamonds and smuggling them in their coat. I agree with that. I really hope it works. I worry about the government being able to monitor transactions because they control the internet and they see everything that goes on either through cell phones or through the actual physical wires because it's an autocratic nation that doesn't have any laws that can monitor you. Like, I just kind of worry about the logistics of this. Like, it's hard. And by the way, it's fine. I agree. Like, this is an interesting use case. It's kind of like almost the only one where I'm like, okay, that makes sense for this little window.
That was my goal. My goal was to get you to find the at least one because it's a spectrum. And now we know that you're on the spectrum.
Yeah, definitely on the spectrum. No, I love. I will fully readily say if somebody is trying to escape, and they have a better mechanism to do so, owning Bitcoin or Ethereum or frankly anything that has at least some semblance of stability out there. And I agree, there will always be some like blockchain that has some semblance of holding it. Not everything's going to zero, clearly. That this is like a nice alternative for them. My worry is like, okay, that makes sense. Where's the rest of the market that we're holding up in these use cases that are supposed to be more on a consistent basis? Because that is that's like the one-time use case, right? You hopefully only have to use that one time. And then eventually you want to get your Bitcoin back to fiat in the country that you escape to, right? Because you want to use it.
I mean, similar to how if you hold gold, you want to get it into some fungible thing that you can go use in that new place. Like if you make it to the promised land or America. Anyways, Glad that we're in agreement on it.
We nailed it. Logan, podcast over. Zach admitted there's a use case in Bitcoin that makes sense. Okay, yeah, sounds good. That works for me.
I knew you were on board with the smuggling out of autocratic nations.
I'm on board.
The question is just how big is you know, I mean, obviously there's been from a quality of human life standpoint, like it's amazing that this can exist, right?
I think we probably agree on like at least 90% of things, even in crypto, and probably even more than that outside of crypto.
Maybe the part that is frustrating about all of this is like then people take these logical leaps to the next set of conclusions, which are just like generally not true or accurate. And then we have, you know, what I think of as the hype cycle, because people take this idea, they're like, well, if one person could do it, imagine if all, it's just like, that's just not how this actually plays out in any way. So my issue with the whole thing is not the like alternative for an individual. I actually think that's fantastic and I'm glad we have it. It's this idea that we've invested like, I don't know, $90 billion or something in an industry where that money could have been gone, like spent on more interesting, useful things in the long run.
Companies, you know, could have gone to your...
Could have been in like, I don't know, a biotech accelerator started by like a former tech founder with some other folks like that. And maybe one of those or, you know, anything else really, not just biotech. So, but yeah, look, having an alternative for an individual, like it's hard to argue that that's not a good thing.
Sean, one of the things that in these use cases that we're talking about, like there's a lot of either technical acumen required by people to be able to do this or a lot of middlemen and brokers to enable some of this stuff, right? And inevitably the on-ramp, as things get easier, you need companies behind them for the on-ramp to exist, right? To like lower the barrier so that it broadens out. Which then leads to centralization inevitably, right? Because now those people control. You can see it with, you know, OpenSea, right? When people are, you know, claim that they've been hacked.
The Moxie, post, the Jack Dorsey comments. Look, I agree with 90, and Moxie's friend of mine, I agree with 95% of all of that. I would just say, and we can table the Web3 conversation as I get our crypto conversation, move on to something else. I would just say, I think you guys know now what motivated me into the space. And with everything else, I, you know, at Sequoia, we haven't made nearly as many investments as other people. We try to be very principled. We've mainly invested in infrastructure, like totally acknowledge the centralization and totally acknowledge the weird dichotomy of like, if you want to have mass onboarding of people, it's going to create a lot of centralization. And that is a weird kind of perverse thing.
Would you, because now I can move away from, you know, I get your take on it. Like, would you invest your dollars as Sean, not Sequoia partner Sean, but just Sean, or Joel, in...
I was going to make...
as an LP in like a crypto specific venture fund, like, would you put your money into it?
Trading firm, probably, you know, I was an algorithm trader in the past and like, but that's a completely different beast. You know,
you're not betting on the ultimate outcome. Yeah. You're betting on the volatility. Yeah.
And in terms of crypto funds, like, I mean, look, trading is in a different category and it's also a different category of utility. I would invest in Paradigm. I think they're really smart. And I would invest in Sequoia because I think we're patient and have a long-term view on all of this stuff. And we're, you know,
one of the benefits of investing in Sequoia is you get the rest of the portfolio. It's pretty damn good. I too would invest in Sequoia.
Yeah, I was going to say, both of them come out in favor of investing in Sequoia, Sean.
You're like, Sean, would you invest in the best performing venture fund in the history of the world over and over? Like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
One really interesting thing you said, and it's funny because I do think this distinction is very unclear to a lot of people, is the difference between the like crypto trading and hedge fund types where they take effectively no opinion on the final outcome. They just trade the volatility and, you know, it's like a money-making machine.
On margin at times, and sometimes, you know, get out in front of their skis. But yeah.
Well, some do, some don't. Some do.
People with zero risk management experience are...
But that's like, to me, it's so interesting because there's a lot of people making money in crypto as LPs in the trading firms that look a lot more like Citadel as a trading group.
I was an algorithmic trader at DRW in 2008. And like
some of my smartest kind of math oriented friends, it's really funny. You talk to them and they're like, yeah, trading in crypto is amazing. And then you're like, cool, what use cases are you interested in? They're like, the retail idiots. That's the use case I'm interested in because, like, I can make a ton of money.
You don't know where the yield comes from. You are the yield.
Yeah.
But I do two more things to say that are short points are, like, one, I do think that there is real innovation happening in the space. And, like, all of, like, those people are often not very quiet, actually. Like it's the loud, get-rich-quick people that are like, you hear the most of. But there's real innovation. I think, like, from a computer science perspective, it's pretty easy to argue that both Bitcoin and Ethereum have very interesting properties, like from a computer science perspective. Ethereum is a shitty distributed computer. It's like...
Yeah, it's like a horrible distributed computer, but it works. It works. Yeah.
It's 8 orders of magnitude worse than AWS. Like, it's 8 orders of magnitude more inefficient.
I mean, I always hear the, like, smart people are building cool stuff. There is cool stuff getting built. I consistently hear those words.
Yeah.
And then I never hear any details that actually are interesting at any scale besides kind of like
some examples if you want.
Yeah, it'd be great.
I would say there's three things like and more, but like there's a few things on top of Ethereum that I've found really interesting. So one is a video game called Dark Forest, ZK.GAME, created by an MIT dropout. Brilliant math kid, Brian Gu. And it's, first of all, like, it's just really fun to play. If you're a hacker, if you're a weird hacker, like, it's playing it was the most fun I had playing a game since, like, since I first played Counter-Strike. And I didn't mention, but I was a professional Counter-Strike player as a kid. The game is, like, it literally fully runs on a blockchain. Like the whole thing, and it's not running on Ethereum. It'd be way too expensive. It's running on a side chain of DAI, a stablecoin, this thing called XDAI. But the whole game is running on a blockchain. So every action you want to take in the game, you have to pay a fee. Like you're paying to operate the blockchain. Another one that I think you'll probably disagree with, but with Uniswap, like I think just what it is absolutely fascinating. Like this is a in some sense, it's a company where, and I'm not saying Uniswap, the company, but Uniswap, the protocol that runs.
Yeah. We actually talked about it. We talked about it yesterday with a guy, John, who brought it up as like a cool use case. It's like the most, I hate to keep using libertarian, but it is the most libertarian trading system ever created, which is like
imagine,
crazy.
Imagine you create a company where like you create a company and you launch into space or like, you know, like on when we said, like Voyager space probe into the outer atmosphere or sorry, into the like outer solar system. It's like you write the software on there and it's just going to go play.
Yeah. And just does its thing. Totally.
Forever. And Uniswap is that like when you ship the code, when you launch the smart contract, this is just a coin vending machine that's going to exist forever as long as Ethereum exists.
Logan, what did he call it? He was like, it's like the biggest gambling house ever created. He had some funny phrase for it.
It's a casino that you're launching into space. Yeah. That's like never. That just cannot, you cannot change the trajectory. You can launch Uniswap V3 or Uniswap V4, V5 and hope that people will start using that instead of the old ones. But like this thing is just going to exist forever. And that idea that you can have a business that makes money and like does something, like I just think that's an insane idea. And you can have the thing spit off cash into a wallet that you own where no one knows who you are into perpetuity. That's not what they did. But I'm just saying intellectually, it's pretty, there's all sorts of problems with it, but intellectually, it's a pretty fascinating thing. And then the third one is, and like, so overhyped. I have so many issues with it, et cetera. But like with NFTs, I do think there's some really interesting properties. Like the idea that an artist, you know, like you have some digital item And you can program in future revenue royalty streams forever that, like, you know, anytime my Van Gogh painting sells, it's digital, only the digital copy or whatever, sells, like, my estate is going to get 1% fee every time it sells forever. Like, that's a, I just think that's a fascinating thing. And I'm not saying that's a big utility, but I'm saying it's a, these things really have captivated my imagination. And I just think we're so early into all of this. And I'm not going to come here and shill any one particular program, any one particular thing. I think most of it's going to go away. Most people are idiots. But, like, I do think there's some really interesting innovation there.
I want to contrast that little piece with probably, I know you didn't do the fundraising, but, like, what the LP story was for all these crypto funds is, like, we just described, like, you know, $100 million of market cap total. And that's $100 million.
That's what I think is interesting in this is, and this is sort of where I struggle, is I agree with your, certainly your example of, you know, your wife's family having to deal with that, right? Like, that's an amazing utility. And I don't know how big that is, but, it's kind of people that live within authoritarian regimes that have money that are able, you know, whatever. And so we can debate how big that is. And then there's the wallet as a social identity thing, which I'm not totally sure how the incentive structure would play out to get there, to get to that state that, like, people would. But let's say we can get there. That's great. And then there's the three examples you just laid out, which I think are all super cool. And then there's the idealized state of, like, what this could all be way in the future. And, like, I think that's awesome if there's more checks and balances on government or whatever it is. Like, I can imagine all that. In between, I think this is where I struggle, is just, like, how much capital and hype has gone into the ecosystem. It's hard for me to foot that with, and it sounds like we're kind of saying similar things, that, like, hey, this might not be the biggest market today, but there's some use cases that are either super addicting or super cool, like Uniswap or that game you've played. And then there's other use cases that are maybe small and niche, but super important, right? Which is your wife's family fleeing Iran. And then there's the stuff way in the future that could be, but, you know, it's hard to say how we get from here to there. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is fair. And I would just say that, like, look, we raised a $500 million fund when, as Sequoia, we, like, look at the size of funds of individuals.
Sure.
Like, we,
your Indonesia fund is bigger than that, right?
Like we did that intentionally. Obviously, we do everything intentionally. That's point one. Point two is, like, we can trade in the fund, and so, you know, like, the market cap for trading is very, very large. And then three, I think what we're all saying, but I just want to emphasize, is, like, I think there's some really fascinating experiments being run and some really brilliant people going into the space. And, like, as I mentioned early on, like, I built my first computer when I was 7 in 1992. And I just feel the same feelings I had in the early days of computing and internet. And it's like, I don't know what that counts for, but on a 20-year time frame, I think following where really smart people go and where young energy, like, and enthusiasm goes is oftentimes a pretty good strategy.
I keep hearing them. Well, look at all the young people doing this thing. But, like, a lot of young people make very dumb decisions at the end of a bull market.
Exactly.
Right? Like, okay. That one bothers Zach, me.
Let's narrow this to IMO gold medalists. Like, let's see where they're going. And IMO gold medalists, it's a very different metric than Harvard HBS grads, where, you know, Harvard HBS grads have had a very different signal than IMO gold medalists. Like, I would say the number one gainer of everything of where IMO gold medalists is going, of every sector in the world over the last 5 years, has been crypto. And in particular,
and Ramp, by the way, Ramp has a few. So there's, yeah, it's Vitalik, and then it's the Wu brothers over the, yeah.
And then the subcategory within that is in zero knowledge proofs. And something that I, like, having a PhD in math and physics, and I didn't say, but I have three master's degrees. Like, I've started a PhD, and I've done it in math department, it's like machine learning, statistics, like robotics. We would be talking about these computer science ideas 15 years ago of like zero knowledge proofs, all sorts of like homomorphic encryption, et cetera. And these have kind of been holy grail ideas in computer science. And not only are we now finding applications of these ideas, and I'm not saying they're like commercial applications today, but we're finding actual applications and we're also putting them into production. And it's just incredibly intellectually interesting. And that's attracting literally some of the smartest people in the world from like a math genius perspective. And so let's, instead of saying follow the HBS grads, let's say follow the IMO gold medalists. And I think that's a decent strategy.
Well, I think we agree. Like, listen, there's cool tech here. I don't think anyone would say like these are very cool. Like Uniswap's amazing, right? And the computational problem. And so I would never push back. And Vitalik seems brilliant. I think the concern or the question in all of this is at what cost, both to the dollars that are going in, as well as the other problems that could be solved. And so it's one of those things. It's almost like, what if you're wrong? Like what? Why be a cynic here, right? It's one of these things that, hey, if it works out, it's great in the future. And that's...
So I actually, like, look, I think it's my job. It's my duty to call bullshit on things. And I have tried to, when I think that something is a scam, like, I try to call it out.
I mean, it's a shame, honestly. I was making jokes the entire time while the NFT run-up and all that stuff. And people internally can tell you I was definitely... a cynic on pushing back on some different things. It's a shame that like this kind of manifested itself at a point. I almost wish we were having this discussion 6 months ago.
Yeah.
It feels like we're punching down and dancing on the grave a little bit when the market is where it is, you know?
Well, you know, we were told that we get to read, write, and own. And I was promised read, writing, and owning things for a very long time through a very big press machine that turned out to not know what it's talking about, as evidenced by some of the recent clips that show they literally don't know what they're talking about in this bay. Shocking.
Well, newsflash. The hype machine, you know, yeah, almost never knows what it's talking about.
Oh, God.
I genuinely think the criticism has been good. Like Aaron Levy, Moxie, Jack Dorsey, you guys, like, I think the criticism, you're 99% right. But I think that there's a real chance that this is a very important trend, like new technology over the next 30 years. And so it's just, we got to balance.
You know, by the way, that's what I respect the most about the people that are coming on and having this conversation, because it's tough to do this right now. Like it would have been when the market was up, it's really hard to do it. And so now I think is the best time to be doing this, because let's have a conversation when the bullshit's out, and let's see who genuinely believes in this stuff. And so I guess I respect your willingness to come in and do this, because it's hard. One, it always sounds better to be a cynic than an optimist, right? Just because if there's a 20% chance this works out, then, you know, there's 80% of chance.
Yeah, the probability is not in your favor.
The probability is not in your favor. And two, I think this is the right time to be defending this stuff, because I know there's a lot of people doubting everything that we're talking about, right? And so it feels like hopefully this is becoming an elevated platform for the people that really do believe it. Like, let's convince it. Let's convince the, you know, people that are a little at the margin, right? And, you know, eventually this, we'll find out, right?
The market will tell us.
Logan was concerned that the kids that sold weed in high school were going to be richer than him. And that's really why I'm here, is to make sure for you, Logan, that that does not happen. So
I appreciate that. Yeah, no, that's back to Sean, your fraud versus smart people thing. That's the spectrum of stuff that I had. It's really the PhD students like yourself. And then the drug dealers are the two people that seem to the input.
That's basically the two phenotypes in the space, but I'm just kidding.
I mean, it's kind of true.
Yeah, that's what led to the rhetoric being as negative as it has been. But
you're right.
Yeah, you're right. I really appreciate you doing this.
Last thing we'll say, guys, like, thanks for having me on, and I hope we all become friends. Like, you know, we all have a lot in common, and you know, I genuinely hope to see you guys in real life someday and do all that.
Totally. Let us know when through New York. Thanks for doing this, Sean.
Peace.
See you, man.
Andrew, how are we doing?
Wonderful.
Thanks for doing this. Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here today.
Yeah, totally. So you just got back from Israel?
Yes. I actually went to Capri for 3 days with 40 friends. And then I went to Israel for 9 days.
Without 40 friends.
Yeah, maybe next time.
Yeah, next time.
With my girlfriend, Rumi.
Yeah, well, how was Israel?
Israel's amazing. You know, Jewish guy from South Florida. I've never been there before. Always talked about doing Birthright, but my girlfriend's born and raised in Israel, so she was a good tour guide. Went all over.
What is it that Romy's family calls you? There's a Hebrew word for something?
Satlan, which is effectively, I think, means goofball.
Goofball.
Yeah. For lack of a better term. And I actually, when I met her family this trip, I go up to her mom and I go, Romy says I'm a Satlan, and her mom literally lost it.
That's amazing.
So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this. We were down in Florida together for Miami Tech Week, and we had 3 straight days of dinner. And I wanted to have you on for a couple of reasons. One, I think you're fun to hang with. We've gotten to be buddies.
Thank you. I'll take that.
Yeah.
You're fun to hang out with.
Thank you. We'll just compliment each other for an hour here. Two, your business is, I think, fascinating, which we can talk about. You've also, you've been an OG Miami guy for predating the new influx, which I would love to get your opinion on. You've also raised from some interesting people in the venture ecosystem. So SoftBank and Tiger and among others, right? So I think we'll play the hits. We'll go through a bunch of that stuff. But maybe we'll start out. How do we know each other?
Well, so I've known of your fun for a while. You know, as you said, I'm from Miami, and Miami Tech wasn't a thing 5 years ago when I started Papa, and I never heard of Redpoint or most of the venture capital funds. I never heard of Y Combinator. But after that, I did try to raise money from you. We never met. But I saw you on Twitter, which I am not on Twitter.
You're kind of on Twitter. I mean, you're like literally on Twitter.
I'm technically on Twitter.
Yeah. You have a Twitter account.
I have a Twitter account, but my tweets are quite limited. However, for some reason, I thought you were cool. Talking about hip hop, talking about venture. Seemed like a good guy. And I actually just looked at it. I was trying to figure out how we met each other. And let's see if I can pull it up here. It's kind of weird, actually, because I've only used Twitter for two real purposes, and it was to meet you, and it was to meet the mayor of Miami.
Equally important people.
So, one more than the other.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
And this is like a cold email, effectively. I said, you a comedian or a VC or both? Funny tweets, would love to meet, love hip hop and company building, let me know. You responded in minutes, and we've been friends ever since.
Yeah. So you spent time with our early stage team when you were raising your Series A.
Probably a couple of the series, but yeah, for sure. A. I actually remember waiting like 45 minutes downstairs at your office, and I'm like, are they coming? Like, I've been waiting here. I'm 7 minutes into waiting, and they're like, you're in the wrong building. So
I was like, we're going to cut that out, by the way. Us keeping entrepreneurs waiting. No. And then you, when you were raising a growth round, either from Tiger or SoftBank or something, you came to me and said, hey, I'm raising. What do you think? And I said, your business is too complicated. It seems too hard to execute on.
Not wrong.
Yeah, it is complicated. I was like, I like these little software things that don't actually involve moving people around and you know, managing all the complex logistics that you have to do. But it's amazing what you've been able to build.
Yeah, just for high level, Papa is a platform that connects older people and families to what we call pals. They provide companionship and assistance. They drive you. They help you around the house. They teach you to use technology. They'll maybe set you up with the ability to watch this podcast. And all of it's through health insurance, through Medicare Advantage and Medicaid and employers as a benefit. It is complicated. In fact, I don't think any of the venture capital funds understood it. They all tried to put us into this, like, we're Uber, we're a marketplace. And yes, to some degree, we have those elements, but it's very complex. We do visits in like the middle of nowhere, Idaho. It's not, you can't get like network effects in the middle of Arkansas, you know, kind of far out from a city. So we have like a different platform in every city, pretty much, effectively.
It's wild. And I think it's all kind of held together. The reason in my mind it works versus, you know, there were all these Uber for, right, babysitting or for, you know, whatever, laundry or all these things. And inevitably people would take someone off the platform, right? That was what they would do. It's like, yeah. Hey, I would, but your business is kind of held together because you monetize through payers, right?
I used to love when the VCs would ask me, like, oh, isn't there disintermediation? And I go, well, no, it's free. So why would they do that? But we have an interesting kind of phenomenon happening because it's free to the members and the pals know that. We do have examples where the pals like, why don't I come over tomorrow? Why don't I come over for Wednesday? You know what? Why don't I just do it every single day for the rest of my life? I'll come over twice. And so I don't know what the term would be. We could come up with one, but it's interesting. It's the opposite problem because every time someone uses it, we get paid by the health plan. We effectively are, that's our costs.
24-year-olds just hanging out with 75-year-olds every day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we used to be college kids and now we're really anyone. You have to go through the process. Personality is a big part of it.
So I want to get into the business itself because I think that's fascinating. But so you grew up in South Florida, went to Florida State.
Yes.
Which is not the, I don't know how many entrepreneurs in the tech world are. The
founder of Spanx went there.
Is that right?
Yeah, which is pretty cool. She was on Shark Tank.
Is that right?
Yeah, so.
There's some Seminoles out there in the
tech. Yeah, she sold her company for quite a large sum.
So how, how'd you
But get, yeah, it's pretty limited, to be honest.
Yeah. So we have two.
Yeah.
Yeah. So take me to like your entrepreneurial journey. I had heard you mention you applied for 400 jobs or you were rejected from 400 jobs? I guess both. Yeah.
I don't think you could do one without the other. So, you know, I grew up in South Florida. My dad's an entrepreneur. My grandpa was an entrepreneur. I recently realized everyone blood related to me is an entrepreneur.
Wow.
And I don't even like that word to be clear, but I don't know if there's a better way to explain it, but some are jewelers, some are, you know, doctors, some own huge health tech companies and other. And so I've just always been part of like what I thought is the, I didn't realize getting a job was like a thing.
Yeah.
And so I went to school for finance. I did fine.
Sounds like you weren't very good at getting a job.
Yeah, I was not. Well, they all told me I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I didn't know that I needed to pay rent. Like, and I needed to have lunch. Like, you know, so after college, that was a little bit of a struggle. I got one job. Well, I got two jobs actually.
Yeah, but one.
Well, I got two jobs. So one of the jobs that I got was with Raymond James.
Oh, I didn't. Okay.
And the interview process was to try to get contact information of people in your area. And I remember like I was being absurd with it, but I like ran with a guy that I saw running and like in real time with a pen trying to get his phone number. And they told me I got more phone numbers and contact information and like the history of them doing this assessment. So I got that job, which wasn't really what I wanted. And then I got a sales job doing, which was terrible, actually. Door to door, 110 degree weather in Florida, humid, in a suit, asking small businesses if they wanted to buy a $400 phone system. And they could only buy it if they had the other piece, which is like an insane.
You don't seem like a suit door to door guy. I think you've manifested the Nike and Papa hat and all. I think
this is me.
I think
the real me is here.
The real you has come out. And then you went to go work at a health tech company.
Yes. My dad actually started a telehealth company called MD Live. Telehealth wasn't a thing. This is 12 years ago. It wasn't a big company. I just so badly wanted to be in a startup and it was right there. So it was my dad, you know, this head of sales, this guy, Chuck, a few others, Justin, our lawyer, and then, you know, a few others and me.
It was, I'm glad you didn't count that one in like the jobs you got, by the way. That's why I was laughing. I was like, you're working with your dad. I don't know if that's the same. Yeah.
If you met my dad, you would know that that's harder than most of the 400 jobs I got tonight.
But you joined early. You were what, 12, 15 people at the time?
120 people when I was part of the company.
And it, huge success, right?
Yeah. So I was a salesperson. The company grew to 400 people. It sold to Cigna for a large sum. About a year ago, you know, I've since left, but it was a good outcome. It was a lot of learning there. I mean, we were early in telehealth. We had to explain to people what telehealth was. And then we had to explain to them, you got to buy us. And people didn't really get it. You know, and all the telehealth companies that exist now, they wouldn't have been possible before because we weren't allowed to do asynchronous. You weren't allowed to send medicine in this way. You know, it was very specific, but learned so much there. And then I came up with this idea to help my grandpa.
What year was that?
So technically I came up with the concept of Papa in, end of 2015. So early 2016.
And so the original idea of Papa, like how did it come to you that you were going to go do this?
So I had an idea, which I think is not that smart, but it kind of evolved, which was, an on-demand assistant. I was not technical. I don't know how to code. I just, you know, I'm kind of a scrappy hacking founder in the early days, at least. I've evolved, I've advanced. And so I thought about like on-demand assistance. It would be a simple app. You press a button. It would call me at first. I would go help you with various services.
For consumers.
Anything? For anyone. Just was not focused on seniors. But then one day I called my cousin. I said, you always have good ideas. I always have good ideas. Let's meet at my house right now and come up with ideas. 5 minutes into that, I'm talking about my on-demand assistance app. He's talking about our grandpa and Papa needs help. And we're like, what if we pair Papa with on-demand assistance? And he's like, we could use College Kids. He loved College Kids. And I said, oh my God, it's genius. And then we created Papa Technologies LLC that same day, which is like a 1990s like IT telecom company of some sort. Put my life savings, which at the time was pretty minimal, and started building an app from developers that we hired in Argentina.
Papa was what you actually called your grandfather too, right?
Yes. So my grandpa from Argentina moved here, you know, right as my mom was born, like 62 years ago. He's since passed, and he was the inspiration for Papa.
And so take me through how the idea evolved. Were payers at the center of the monetization model originally? Like, what was the early days? I know at one point you met a co-founder through LinkedIn, kind of cold.
Yeah. So we had the idea of Papa. I was still working at MD Live. It was more of a fun thing. Like, we were really building the app, but like that took like 6 to 8 months. And we're so excited we have the app, and like no one used it, obviously. Like, we're, you know, begging friends, like literally begging, like, stop calling me. Like, I don't even have grandparents. Why are you asking me?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have uncles? Do you have neighbors? Like, do you got anyone?
Do you know old people?
Yeah. Do you have any old people in your vicinity? We did get one
going over to the villages, just like going door to door. Yeah.
Well, the door to door sales experience came back, and it's like, wow, that's actually, you get used to getting a lot of no's.
Florida's a good place for old people, though. So,
it's a good place now, everyone realizes. Yeah. The old people, they're early adopters.
Yeah, exactly. Ahead of the curve. Famously old people ahead of the curve on things.
Old people are very innovative, so don't forget that. So it, you know, started very slow, and but then what happened was I was kind of hit my, you know, end at MD Live. I felt like I learned a lot. I grew, the company was pretty massive at the time.
How many people?
You know, 400 people, 30 million members had access to MD Live, telehealth had exploded.
And you guys were monetizing through payers there
and,
as
So my job was still in employers and payers and employees. So that's all I knew. So I don't know anything about consumers or Facebook ads or anything like that. So I wanted to go after payers, but at the time there was no way for them to pay for it.
I wanted to go after payers is like that. That's a really a small market of people that are willing to bang their head against the wall trying to sell to payers.
It's funny though, because to me it's more just like natural because that's what I did.
Yeah.
I have no, I didn't know what a cohort analysis was. I don't know what the hell CAC is. I didn't know any of those things. I just knew how to sell and convince people that this is a value. And I knew that it was something they needed. We have a new network of care that could help people that can be deployed. That's not clinical when there's shortage of doctors and nurses. Now, whole new network, hundreds of years, it's been doctors, nurses, caregivers, and now there's PALs.
So what, maybe take through the state of health insurance, just to help crystallize why this part of it kind of holds the business together. And this was when we were talking about it, I was like, okay, so on one side you have old people, on the other side you have college kids, and on the third you have health insurance plans. And so it's a three-sided market essentially. And I was like, all of those things sound bad to me. Like, health plan sounds bad. Old people sound bad. Young people sound bad. So that was what, and moving people around, not being able to sell it over the internet via software. All those things sounded bad to me. So
if I was only smarter.
Listen, you figured it out. God bless you here. So,
sometimes I say being naive is one of my greatest skills.
It's amazing.
So we built a simple platform that allowed us to request PALs or onboard PALs, which are the companions. They do drive too. So there's a lot of elements. They're driving, they're growing the house, there's trust. Obviously, there's safety and quality. And then, of course, you want to make the unit economics work. So we were hiring PALs, and we do, of course, now, and our system does it automatically. And then we work with health plans today. So today, Pop has 100 managed care organizations, which is what like someone that's been in payer space for 20 years or 10 years would say, which pay us a membership fee effectively for their members to have access to Papa. And we enroll people over the phone. They could use the app, whatever, you know, is most comfortable. And a PAL shows up every week, once a month, once, not at all, depending on the need. And the reason this works and the reason health plans buy us is what you're talking about, which is really the shift in healthcare from like use-based care, like fee-for-service, like every time I go to the doctor, I pay or my insurance pays, to value-based care, which is I'm, you know, the health plans are getting paid money by the government to manage my healthcare. It's very interesting.
So my grandmother has access to Medicare. And so you will sell into Medicare or private health insurance plans and say, hey, you should use Papa, and we'll send anyone, but people that we've vetted out to spend time with my grandmother. And it, you can help on these people. What are the qualifications of the people that you're sending?
A pal is like a professionally nice person. We remove the no bathing, no toileting. It's an extension to the family. We used to call it family on demand. But, you know, are they a good driver? Do they have a nice personality? Are they trustworthy? Are they caring? Do they self-select into this? Are they, do they have any experience? Are they a family caregiver themselves? Maybe they had a parent or a grandparent that they cared for. So it's evolved beyond college students, that we have nursing students. But the qualifications is you went through and you became a pal. And then we monitored. And it's all through, you know, logistical technology. And we're starting to use AI even to understand, like, who's going to likely use it, when they're going to use it, why they're going to use it. And the reason the health plans love it is because a pal goes to the house and they're like, wow, you haven't been to the doctor in 5 years. Do you want me to take you to the doctor? You don't take your medicine. And the person complains about, you know, having an issue. They're like, I need to go to the hospital. And the pal's like, well, did you know you have telehealth? You know, so the pals become this connective tissue for healthcare. And if you're a health plan and you get paid a certain amount of money to care for someone, you want to make sure to do that in the most effective, least costly way. But then we also want to make sure they're getting cared for. So the government, like, gives you these requirements that you have to hit. And so it's a very balanced system that allows for high quality and good experience. And then Papa, the pals, or as I call them, the ninjas, have been purposely built to, like, support that, that kind of value-based care initiative.
It's a value-based care. Basically, it, we're shifting from, hey, just getting paid for doing a service to, let's actually try to bend outcomes and change. And so, hey, if this, this grandmother is not taking her medicine, that is going to put her in the ER, and, you know, who knows? Maybe she's diabetic.
Or she could die.
Or she could die. And the cost of someone being on life support or whatever is just infinitely higher than it is to send someone over to the house for a couple hours a day.
Exactly. And it's so nuanced. So we're using data to understand personalization. What happens to a 90-year-old person today, their whole life can change tomorrow. They fall, they break a hip, suddenly they can't get up. They're not able to get to the grocery store. They can't eat healthy food. And, you know, loneliness is really the underlying problem. But, you know, there's many, like, little aspects to that. And so we've been to members' houses where the pals, you know, they're a complete hoarder. It's a disaster. And they're in an unsafe environment. And there's animals that are dead. Like, sometimes it's bad. Most of the time, they're hanging out and helping out. They're getting groceries. They're making them happy. Because when you're happy mentally and physically, you're going to be living longer and you're going to have a healthier life.
So average age of a pal is?
Now it's about 30.
30. And average age of a, what are you, customer? I don't know.
Yeah, so our average older adult, we call them members, is about 75, 80. But today we've expanded, not today, over the course of the last couple of years, we've expanded to family care.
Yeah.
So we'll go spend time with a mother that has three kids that's trying to get a job and is on Medicaid and can't get to the doctor because they don't have a car. A pal will help provide that service. Or we work with large employers, their employees who have family members older or younger, or themselves that need help. So we're doing kind of more people helping people.
I want to get into the working mom situation in a second. But on the, so, I mean, my grandmother is in good mental capacity, and I think,
that's
could, awesome. Yeah, 89. And I think could handle herself with a stranger coming in, right? But how does that work? How do you get people comfortable? Like, some people have early onset dementia, or maybe they have all on dementia, and you don't do bathing and some of that stuff as well. But so how do you get people comfortable that, like, this random person's going to come into the house?
The secret thing is the pal. I mean, if I come to someone's house and I'm a pal, Papa's core values, be a pal. One of our core values, literally, you have to do visits. I did visits 2 weeks ago. I took this old guy to get a new passport, actually. You know, if you're a nice, friendly, kind person and you don't seem like a doctor, so it's a paradigm shift. My grandpa jumped out the window when a home care professional came over. He bit a person. You know, he had dementia. He had passed away from Alzheimer's later. But then when we got him a pal, which was just like me, kind of, every guard went down. He's like, oh, Logan's coming over. I get to hang out with Logan. You're not a nurse. You're not a doctor. You're not there to prick and prod. You're not there to, you know, make you uncomfortable. You're just there to hang out and help out. And so we've just seen members love it. Like, they're just very accepting. With families, there's a higher level of, like, who's coming over and why. And that's why our brand and our quality, you know, speaks for itself.
And so initially, you couldn't promise that the same person would come back necessarily, right?
Before it was like a random pal, but now it is actually a preferred pal.
And so they're not taking them off the network because of because they monetize through the payer side. So there's no incentive to be like, hey, you know, grandpa, give
not
me $40, right? And so these people are in the house, and what's the typical length of time that they're doing it, all that stuff?
Yeah, the average visit is like 2.5 hours. So it's quite a bit. In fact, I think we're one of the highest utilized healthcare services. And the secret there is that in telehealth days, you have to be sick to use telehealth. You have an acute need. I have a cold. I have a cough. I have pink eye. With Papa, you have to have an unmet social need. Like almost 100% of people have some version of an unmet social need. So maybe you're lonely. Maybe you don't have a car. Maybe you don't have food. Maybe you just want to talk to somebody. Maybe you want to know how to use your benefits. A pal could help with all of those things.
And so how are you vetting the people? I know it's your approval rate is high single digits, something like that, of people that apply.
Oh, the pals.
Of pals.
Yeah, yeah. So what's interesting is we have to vet the pals, but also not forget that we also have to vet the members.
Yeah.
To some degree, it's much harder. They're semi-vetted because they're tied to the health plan, and at least you know more about them. But the pals, less than 10% of those that apply get on. And we've just been getting better and better at understanding like who is the right pal. Frankly, the best pals right now, and it's becoming more of the majority, are ones that are like family caregivers. Like my stepmom, whose kids just went to college, she has been a family caregiver. She's the best. And she likes helping people, and she wants to make a little bit extra money, for example.
And so are they doing this on demand, or does it end up being scheduled? How does it actually work?
So like Uber, you have an app, and I could look and see that there's visits in my area. Most visits are scheduled 24 to 72 hours out in advance. And the way we found is pals go in, and they're like, here's my schedule, boom, boom, boom. They accept all the visits out to their calendar, and they're treating it like a mini business now. It's very cool. And something really exciting, and they're very passionate about it. Because think about this, by removing bathing and toileting, I've now unlocked a whole new network of supply that did not look at this industry before because they couldn't, and now they can. And they don't want to be Uber drivers. They don't want to do DoorDash. You know, my stepmom's never going to do DoorDash, but she wants to do something. And so that's why Papa's been really successful on the supply side. We're not having this like great resignation problem. Our CAC has come down like so much. And it's honestly the mission-driven aspect of it is very powerful, and I think more powerful than ever before, both for pals and for our employees, and it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's super cool. So how big is it now on each side?
We have a few million members that have access to Papa through health plans. Not everyone uses it all the time, but that's who has access, and we get paid for those. And then we have about 35,000 pals on the platform. You know, one pal does like supports 30 active members. So because these members have a certain amount of hours they get from the health plan, it actually makes for a better marketplace and drives for a better, you know, allows for a better unit economics because one pal has the ability to support so many. We don't need oversaturation of supply like most ride sharing companies do, because if I press a button, someone's going to be out there right now. But for us, it's like, hey, can we do a visit? Let's do Wednesdays at 9. And then pal can pick it up.
So you have this, it's all 50 states now?
So we are doing visits in like 41 states. And normally you can't scale a marketplace like this, but I know right now, it's actually this big. So Papa's business model is very intense. All of our business, like 80% of it, is decided on one day.
What do you mean it decided on one day?
So we sell mostly to health plans. They have to file benefits with the government the first Monday of June, which I call FBD, which is filed benefit day. And if we are not in a box this big, we're out for a year.
First Monday of June, so 2 weeks
ago. It just happened.
Oh.
And so...
Congratulations.
Well, I didn't tell you if I did well or not.
Yeah.
We did pretty freaking good. And it's awesome because every customer renewed, you know, they want to keep growing, and we're helping more people. And at the same time, we're improving our business metrics. Like, it's hard to grow and improve metrics at the same time, but because ours is sales-driven and ROI and value-driven, that actually isn't true for us.
How do you justify this to health plans from an ROI standpoint? Like, intuitively, preventative care makes sense to me. But then the question ultimately becomes, like, how do you show the ROI on this? I'm sure you built out complicated models.
Sure.
But essentially, you're selling, in some ways, like, anti-loneliness, right? And
which, like, does anyone really care?
Yeah, does anyone
care? People care, like, anecdotally, but, like, what does that mean? And these are businesses.
Totally.
Health plans are accounting firms with doctor networks.
Yeah.
That's literally what they are.
I'm sure they can polish it up and make themselves really empathetic, but, like, if it's not working for their members to bend the cost curve, they're not going to keep going.
What's nice is the way Medicare Advantage is set up is it allows for
maybe explain Medicare Advantage. Yeah.
So Medicare Advantage, about 28 million people. So, like, you know, 2/3 or a little less of American older adults sign up for Medicare Advantage. So they sign up with Humana, Aetna, United, Blues Cross Blue Shield, one of these plans. And maybe it's a $50 premium, $100 premium. Medicare Advantage effectively took the concept of employer benefits and offered it as a Medicare solution so that if I'm an older adult, I could pay a little bit more or even nothing. And I get gym benefits, I get telehealth benefits, I get behavioral health solutions, you know, and then this health plans, every time I sign up, the government gives them $10,000 to $12,000 a year to care for that person.
So Medicare Advantage is basically, people generally know Medicare, but Medicare is health insurance for older people. And Medicare Advantage is serviced by private companies.
Yeah, privately administered and government-sponsored.
Government-sponsored. And it's been, how long has it been around?
It's about, not the exact quote, but I think like 12 to 15 years.
And people really like
it's, And it's supported on both sides of the aisle, from my understanding.
Yeah.
Because it works. It drives better outcomes. It's lower cost for the country. It's helping people, and people like it.
All the reasons that private business is good, but funded by the public government.
And so in fact, it's a good model that, like, maybe the U.S. mail system should consider.
We don't need to go down these rabbit holes. Yes.
That's my next business.
Yeah. There's another podcast for all the political related.
But what's great about it is, so why do they care about PAPA then? Well, I can't get paid by the government if you don't sign up for my health plan. So people like the fact that their health plan's offering this companionship service that could help with various things. So it's a marketing benefit, retention benefit.
But that doesn't, you know.
No, it really moves the needle.
It does.
Because every time your grandma signs up for a health plan, that health plan now just got $10,000. And if PAPA was even a portion of the reason, that's pretty valid.
So, but how do you show that? Like
it's very difficult. Yeah. So that's like kind of, they will market 2 to 4 things, and we're one of them, so we get to take some credit.
Yeah.
You know.
But have you been able
to? And then what we do is we say, you know, why are you with your health plan? Would you leave your health plan if you didn't have PAPA? And so we have shown that people that have PAPA have like a 70% higher chance of staying with their health plan than if they don't.
Makes sense. But on the, I assume you're impacting outcomes.
So
right?
that's the surface level.
Yeah. So that is great. And that's motherhood and apple pie. And that's nice.
It's pretty meaningful.
Though. Yeah, totally. But it's a social good aspect of this, and it's a marketing benefit and all that. My assumption, and I assume what health plans also are excited about, is your ability to actually change outcomes and bend the cost curve.
Yeah.
And so have you been able to get to the point that you can demonstrably show, hey, if someone has a member show up once a week or, you know, whatever, twice a week, these people will be serviced at a lower total cost to the health plan overall?
So we are doing studies as we speak. We've done a couple other ones that are just about to come out. But there was one plan that saw, for example, a $500 per member per month reduction because of PAPA. And it's because some people are using the ED as their, you know, loneliness solution. And every time we go to the ED, it costs, you know, $1,000, you know, to the health plan.
ED is?
It depends on who your speaker is.
In this context, they're not going to the erectile dysfunction.
They're not going to that for sure. Well, maybe, could be the reason. ED is emergency department. Versus ER, emergency room. Anyway, avoidance of these things. And we've been able to prove it.
Yeah.
And so, but now we're going a step further and saying, okay, we help with marketing and retention, which is great. We help reduce costs, which is great. But we also do things that bring value to the health plan of the member and extend the life. So, for example, we want people to go to their annual wellness visit. Well, the health plan says, here's 100,000 people that haven't done that. Throughout your relationship with PAPA, can you make sure that Logan goes to the annual wellness visit, which is going to the doctor and getting your blood work done? And so the PAL facilitates that. But that's worth money to the health plan that has a reduction. Or they want someone to learn a new telehealth app that they have because this person keeps going to the hospital because they have a cold and a flu. The PALs are not directing care, but they're like, hey, did you know you could use your iPad to talk to a doctor? And that saves them money. So there's so much nuance. Or if we go to someone's house and they're social or they're food insecure, you know, people are living on crappy food, really bad food, like worse than any fast food restaurant or, you know, spam type, or they're not eating at all. And so they wither away, they get weaker, they fall, they get sick. So a pal comes over helps them with food. And we track all of that, and then we get credit for it. So we've been able to prove, you know, 3-1 in some plans, 4-1 in some plans. We had one plan that was 8-1 ROI because it's relatively inexpensive.
I believe it. Figuring out the data, I'm sure, is stuff you guys are working hard on.
We work with the health plan's actuaries.
Yeah.
And we sell to the health plan presidents and markets, and then they have to get their actuaries to approve because they're big accounting firms.
So Medicare Advantage is incentivized for this because it's private. I mean, they run like a business, right? They might get paid on the other side by the government, but they
operate as a normal business.
And so what percentage of your market today is Medicare versus Medicare Advantage versus...
So Medicare zero, which is a fee for service. So
yeah.
When you're Medicare, you go to the hospital, Medicare will pay for that. But they're not really managing your health outcomes. They're just paying for sick care, not health care.
Which is a shame.
Yeah, which, by the way, people talk badly about American healthcare, which there is good and bad stuff. Something that all countries that I personally, not I haven't talked to all countries, but the 10 countries that I had some interactions with their health systems, they all like the idea of value-based care.
Yeah.
So they will shift to that. They pay for it no matter what. We don't always do that. So there's some fixing there.
It just leads to weird incentives of like, hey, you know, I'm just going to go to the ER. Why do I, it just messes up the whole model.
It's at its core broken.
Yeah.
So a personal example, I went to the doctor. They're like, your filtration rate is high. You have chronic kidney disease. And I'm like, what? No. And then they send me a nephrologist and he goes, you may have one kidney. He looks me right in the eye and I go, should I be like super nervous about this? And then he sent me to get my kidney check. And like 20 minutes later, they couldn't find my kidney. And then they ended up finding it. And I'm like, this was just them pushing me around so that they could bill my insurance. But if you're getting paid a lump sum of money, you're not going to just send me to unnecessary tests. You're going to take care of me because you're rated on. So the health plans are a business. Wait, and they do get
where
bonuses.
Was your kidney? Was it just like hiding out somewhere?
It was hiding behind my big ass ribs, according to the lady, the person.
But everyone, each person in that step along the way got paid for seeing you. And so it's the reason of always incrementally going to get another MRI or whatever. It's like, hey, who cares?
Also increases cost for us. When you get a $1,200 bill for like a little screw that you got or little stitches, it's because not everyone's paying.
Yeah.
And so you got to take the cost. Someone's got to take it. It's going to be you.
And so it's young, healthy people will end up being overcharged because they need to make up money on ER visits or whatever.
The average hospital in New York probably given up billions of dollars in charity care every year.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's unfortunate. We want to help people, and that's why value-based care is so good, because you are incentivized to help them, not incentivized to just get them to do things unnecessarily. So it's actually, I believe it's a beautiful thing.
Now you're doing family care as well.
So we always wanted to go beyond older adults, and then we do family care. We don't do babysitting, but like parent helper, you know, mother, father helper.
And that is better. Again, all these little things that like babysitter sounds like a good idea, but the bar to have someone actually in your house alone with your kid versus...
And the risk is high. And honestly, our goal is to improve health outcomes and to provide value to family caregivers. And yes, babysitting is definitely a need to some degree, for sure. It's just in terms of the impact we can make, we find it's going to be better when everyone's involved.
Well, and also the liability associated with it and the bar. And that, honestly...
We don't want to deal with the liability of babysitting.
Yeah. Versus if I'm in the other room and my kid's over here and I have, you know, Andrew playing with the kid in the other room, that bar is going to be lower and I can work from home or whatever.
Sadly,
go
it's like kid, dog... grandparents.
Animals in the middle. That's good. Well, that's exciting. So when did you roll that out?
So actually, you asked me earlier if I like always thought I was going to go after health plans. I did, but at the time there was relatively small, so my actual first strategy was not consumer, which that's what we did actually. It was employers as a benefit. That was also what I did at MD Live. The problem with employers is that you could be in New York, your parent could be somewhere else, your kid could be somewhere else. So network is like impossible. How am I, you know, if you go to a large employer that's everywhere, these people could be anywhere.
Well, and also employers, people switch their jobs and therefore switch their insurance. And so versus Medicare Advantage to some extent.
No, you switch. You do switch.
You switch Medicare Advantage?
You may switch because the other company is Papa and you don't.
People
every
switch
year.
Medicare Advantage
every
frequently?
Year.
Really?
They can every single year.
But I assume the turnover at an employer level is much higher than
I don't
Medicare
know,
Advantage.
But if I had to guess, it's not as great. It's not much different.
Interesting.
In fact, it could be higher at Medicare Advantage. A lot of switching happens.
Interesting.
And there's these interesting companies that push you to sign up for a Medicare plan. And like every year you're getting to this website and they're like, sign up for this plan, sign up for this plan. And there's a lot, that's like a lot of back and forth where someone will be like, oh, this year will go this health plan, this year will go that health plan. And it's, so that's why the marketing part is very big.
Yeah. Interesting.
Because of competition. If someone has Papa, they don't have Papa, they get nervous. Huh. The health plan gets nervous. But the employers, so the problem was like, can we fill these visits? To this Papa's platform allows us to fill visits in any place really in the United States within like a day or two. It's pretty amazing. And we're proud of what we built there. But on employers, we couldn't do that because it was just so hard to build network that way. But now that we're everywhere, we just signed up 2 months ago. One of the largest banks went live with Papa. Recently, we have like a huge insurance carrier offering it to all of their employers. All of our health plan clients are looking to offer it to their employer clients. And that's really something special that we have is all these contracts with large payers. We're providing so much value to their members. They're like, hey, could we just roll this into our employer products?
And that is a benefit that they're offering for the most part.
Yep. Yeah.
Like so you don't have to justify the ROI to the same extent of changing outcomes.
And, it's a little bit different. The outcome is there if it's from a healthcare perspective. I mean, it's there more naturally, but in terms of who cares about it, is if it's a health plan that's fully insured, I'm now at risk for the employee's health.
Explain fully insured.
Yeah. So there's two ways for employers to get insurance. You know, if you work for a large employer, you probably are self-funded. Like Google, App, every big employer, even if you have 1,000 employees or more, because kind of the risk profile, as you're saying, when Logan goes to the doctor, I'll just pay the $150 versus paying thousands of dollars for health insurance that he doesn't need.
I don't want to be pooled with the general population. I think that we're big enough and our employee base is generally healthy enough that I would rather take our group rather than pay for a random basket of everyone
else. That's exactly what effectively Medicare Advantage is.
Yes.
But for older people.
Yeah.
Except for instead of Google being the Medicare Advantage plan, you know, they're the employer benefit plan. And they're taking risk. And these are the three biggest costs for employers. Healthcare is one of the three biggest, as you can imagine. And so fully insured means that the insurance carrier is holding the risk. Self-funded means the employer is holding the risk. Healthcare is just a bunch of risk management. That's really what it is.
Yeah.
And Papa fits so well in a world where you're holding risk because you could use PALs to reduce risk in many areas.
In preventative ways.
And so if I'm an insurance carrier and I have a bunch of employers that are fully insured, I would like them to use Papa so that they can have a good experience, so they're not stressed, to reduce the burden. I mean, imagine you have to take your mom to the doctor. The doctor's an hour away. You have to take a whole day off of work. And like you're balancing your parent. It's tiring and hard. And so family caregiver crisis in America is real. It's getting worse. There's like a huge shortage of caregivers. And so really, I believe Papa is the way to solve this.
Yeah, it's amazing. People blame boomers, but there's a lot of them. And they're getting old.
They're getting old. And, you know, they've done a lot for this country and a lot for us. We wouldn't be here without them. So.
Yeah, quite literally. I wouldn't.
All of us came from a boomer in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, that's right. But it is, I mean, in general, like at a very macro level, and we were talking about tweeting at Elon Musk, but there is, like, we do have this population problem, right?
The third person I tweeted at was Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And hopefully my record so far is pretty good. I got you to respond. I got the mayor. So Elon, if you're watching, we saw that he kind of posted that the birth rates are coming down dramatically, which there's various reasons. I don't want to get into the details. I'm not qualified to. But what's interesting is people are having less kids in general. We're seeing what's happening in other countries as well. And if that's happening, who's going to care for these people as they age? Who's going to care for us?
Old people up, old. Young people down.
And guess what? These older people have a huge portion of the spend in the United States and in the world, and they're pretty well off.
Yeah.
And so it's a big market, pretty untapped. We do have a dream one day of doing consumer. I think that's more of a fun concept. Maybe we'll do it again, but maybe to launch other countries. Now that we have this platform that automatically deploys awesome people anywhere we want, one day.
Yeah. Well, we don't have enough time to go into other countries' healthcare systems and the incentives and all that stuff.
I will say that the UK has a chief loneliness. Oh, no, they have a minister of loneliness.
Wow.
Which is a very doom and gloom UK way of saying, you know, which I would say we have a minister of companionship.
Yeah, chief loneliness. That's a
it's a minister of loneliness.
Minister, that's for incels.
Yeah, it was a one-way inbox. I actually emailed them, and I don't know, they're probably pretty lonely themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Well, good. I appreciate you going through all that. Normally, I don't like giving, you know, spend that much time on a business, but I think you just sit at such an interesting inflection point between all of the stuff in our healthcare system, right? And trying to bend the cost of care. So thanks for talking through any of that. Yeah. Fundraising. So yes. Take us through your fundraising history.
So I first raised $500,000 by going around Miami, which was not a tech world at all.
What year is this?
2017. Right. Yeah. So I quit in May of 2017, and the next morning started my personal roadshow around Brickell.
It was probably far harder then. Now Keith would just force feed you money. Raboy would just like jam it down your pockets. But
maybe if I was around, yeah, exactly. If I was like a new startup now, yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe
5 years ago, though, you're just going around.
I never heard of Keith or any of you guys. So, and I didn't really know the venture world at all. I just thought when you start a company, you raise money. I just thought that was intuitive. So,
how was the previous business funded?
Through initially
self-funded,
light self-funding, but my dad had built a big movie distribution company that sold right before Netflix. You could have made Netflix, Dad. And in fact, actually, at MD Live, we spent so much time building a video codec because there's not like off-the-shelf tools. We could have also been Zoom. I mean, there's so many funny, interesting like technologies that we had to build to... It reminds me of the Twitch story.
Yeah, yeah.
How they had to build it. Anyway.
Well, it worked out.
So on the funding side, raised $500,000. I met some guy at the gym. I met someone at a small 10-person Miami dinner. 10 of my friends invested, you know, 10, 20 grand. And it was fun. And then I went to Y Combinator, which I'd never heard of Y Combinator in my life. I thought, why would I do Y Combinator? I could meet VCs of my own, but I made that up. I didn't know any VCs. And so I figured it's impossible for me to get a Y Combinator.
Yeah. How'd you even know Y Combinator exists?
So I started the company with my cousin. He ended up going back to work and before the company really started to grow too fast. And then I was by myself. I raised the money and I was looking for smart health tech people that lived in Florida. I met this random guy. He said, you should meet this guy, Alfredo. And I'm like, okay. And he goes, you could help Alfredo sell his startup. And, you know, I was just trying to be nice. There was no intention other than he sounds cool. Okay, sounds good. We met and Alfredo's business wasn't working well. And I said, what are you good at? He's like, well, I'm like an operator. He built a platform in Venezuela. He just moved to the United States. And, you know, I'm good at marketing. And he showed me his website that he had in Venezuela, which wasn't making him any money, but it had like 40,000 views on it right then and there, like in real time. And for me, like a scrappy sales guy with no skills in that way, I said, do you want to be my chief operating officer? And he goes, well, how much can you pay me? And I said, I could pay you 30 grand plus equity in the new business. And he says, let me talk to my wife. He comes back the next day. He goes, I'll do it for 33 grand. I go, sold.
Wow. And quite a negotiator. Hopefully he's not the one negotiating with payers.
No, he's definitely not. But he's been my co-founder and he's amazing. And without him, we wouldn't be here. So right around that time, we got into Y Combinator. He goes, we should apply to Y Combinator. And I said, sure. It was 2 weeks, 3 weeks late. I uploaded the wrong video by accident. And then when you take it off, you had to re-upload. And so I forgot about Y Combinator. I thought that was a crapshoot. I never got into anything. I'm a Florida State Seminole. I'm not a MIT, Stanford, Harvard kid.
400 job rejections. 400 Florida job State Senate. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. My resume wasn't really the typical. And, you know, so many people apply. So I'm just like waking up one morning, checking through my emails, and I like deleted an email. And I'm like, did that say accommodator? I went into my deleted inbox, said you got an interview. I called Alfredo, who like barely knew me at the time. I'm like, dude, we got an interview. And once we got an interview, we knew it was ours to win because we're pretty good at talking about Papa.
Yeah. So you did that.
Did that, raised money from Initialized Capital, Alexis Ohanian and Gary Tan, and then Ashton Kutcher's fund as well, which was cool. You know, just initially was so cool to have that experience. Demo Day was amazing. Like almost every VC was interested in it that stage. Not you guys. I don't think you were there.
Yeah.
I'd like to say you weren't there.
Yeah.
Maybe you.
Plays well.
Maybe like, this kid seems stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we raised Series A from Canaan. Series B a year later from Comcast, C not too long after that from Tiger, and then D from SoftBank.
I've heard of SoftBank and Tiger.
Yeah, they're pretty popular.
How? Give me your fundraising from SoftBank story.
First of all, very big honor to get an opportunity. Like meeting Masa, just like as a side thing, is super cool. He was very much listening to everything I was saying and. Like my business model, he right away was impressed by the business model.
Someone reached out to you from SoftBank and then said, hey.
We met through various ways over the years. And I was fortunate to meet Lydia, who's on our board, and Angela, who's a board observer. They've been awesome. And just you know, compassionate people that have also built, you know, been behind $30-40 billion companies, you know, so really great honor. It's tough, you know, trying to raise money, but it was during that interesting time where it was less tough than it is definitely today.
What, when was this? When was the
September of 21 we closed. So good timing.
So, and so you go, I've heard that, Masa will meet everyone in person. Did you go to Japan?
Unfortunately, it was still mid COVID. That's one of the things Masa, if you're listening, I would love to come hang out with you in Japan. But it was a very good experience. And for me, like, I love building the business, but these moments are special too. You know, it was really cool. And what's great was Masa has a story about his own personal need that he has. And so it just made me feel really special about what we were building, because no matter who you are in the world, you have family, or you may have family that has a need. And it doesn't matter where you live, what your status is, the needs are affecting you the same way. And so Masa actually had some pals for his family in a way. So it really resonated. And I was so excited. I jumped right in the pool after. I knew I did a good job.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And Tiger as well. So was Tiger, do you have a board member from Tiger?
No, but Jay is involved in Scott. And they've been awesome. They've been very helpful to me. And I take things differently, I think, than other founders. I'm very much excited that we have so many smart people that want to help me. Not every piece of advice is perfect, of course, but that's true with everything. I take it all as data points. And I think for the most part, I've been felt very supportive.
So you're born and raised in South Florida.
I was born in New York, actually, not too far from where we're sitting. Well, I believe I'm actually not sure where we are other than this amazingly unique apartment.
You walked 2 miles to get here. So
after 1.8 miles, the sweat started to come out. So we took a second.
So born in New York, but raised
in Florida. I was at this event with Alexis Ohanian, who's amazing, great friend, great investor, just great person. And we were at this Miami event, Emerge, and him and I were the keynote. And this was like an event that like was the Miami event, but it really, you know, never was as big as it is now. And it's like so cool to see how it's progressed. And we're on stage and I'm sitting, and my mom was there, and I go, you know, my mom never gets to see me. This is so cool. And I was just on stage like talking like this. And I go, you know, we moved here in 1992. People always ask, like, when did you move to Florida in the pandemic? And now I'm like, no. I'm an OG. I moved to Florida. And it wasn't me, though. It was my parents. They were really forward thinking. We moved in 1992, which is the same time Hurricane Andrew hit. I go, so two Andrews. One was more destructive than the other. And, you know, let the audience decide. But I love Florida. I went to San Francisco for Y Combinator. It's just, I'm a South Florida guy. I love New York, too, by the way. That would be my second place. But East Coast guy, and I didn't care about Miami Tech being in Miami. I like my friends not all being tech.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my world is not tech. It's people, really, which is also part of what I do in a living. But it is fun. I mean, I'm definitely like the token Miami guy now.
Yeah.
I think during Miami Tech weekend, I was on like 7 panels.
Is that right?
Something like that. And it's, Miami's awesome. Miami's always been awesome, to be clear.
I love Miami. I came out as a Miami enthusiast a couple of months ago. I kept it pretty quiet for a long time, but now it's known. It's out there for a while. I didn't want to publicly proclaim that.
Well,
I was
before Miami. No, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's great. So what's been your perspective on, some people have gotten a little defensive about people coming in and appropriating, you know, parts of Miami culture.
I mean, yes, I think that probably is happening to a degree, but who cares? And guess what? Miami doesn't care.
Yeah.
Miami doesn't really care, because think about it. The tech scene, yes, it's great. It's growing. It's awesome. It's cool to see these smart people. And being at a coffee shop, I like to think about like what's happening on the ground. Like, you do hear like AI. You hear something about NFTs more than that, probably more than AI.
Maybe not today.
You hear now you hear silence.
Yeah, exactly.
You just hear nothing.
You're crying.
Yeah.
Just sobs.
Tears. Yeah. Tears of sadness. But Miami is really great, and I like that the VCs are seeing it. And I was a little worried about everyone coming to town but to be honest, it's really impossible to change Miami.
Yeah. Well, now you get to see me, you know.
Yeah. Now our friendship has, you know, ever since that initial...
Blossomed that from tweet. Papa.com?
Oh, yeah.
So before you were what? Join Papa?
Which I literally... To build a company and hate the whole time, the website name, like so much... is tiring.
Did you think about like papa.co, papa.io?
I thought about all that stuff. All was taken. So joinpapa.com. This was like the time where join blah 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 was the thing.
And were you thinking of the members? Like who was joining Papa?
it was more, yeah, I guess it was the members.
Members.
What's terrible is because Join Papa like really works too, like as a sentence. So people started calling the company Join Papa.
Yeah.
And that's when I like lost my shit.
Yeah.
We obviously wanted papa.com right away. It was a parked website since 1999. This guy owned it. Every time I would email him, he had it on Sado.com for like $4 million. And I go, hey, I'll buy it for $1,000.
And goes, I would guess Papa or the .com is probably more important to your business than it is the average business for people to find it, right? Much easier. I go to Google for the most part to start my search of finding a website. But like I would guess being able to say the .com to an older person to get familiarized with this is just like...
It's older people. It's help plans. Imagine I say my company's Papa. And you're just going to go to papa.com.
Yeah.
You're just going to do that. It definitely has helped dramatically. It's helped with conversion on the PAL side, which I didn't expect so much. And, you know, the help plans and older people, they don't know about Co or IO or .me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, if you're a SaaS company that's doing some funky stuff with that, like, that's fine. No one cares. Yeah.
So this guy was just squatting on it.
Since 99 or something like
that. It wasn't
like
a sugar daddy website.
It was nothing.
Something.
It literally had nothing on it. And so I would be like, okay, 1,000. He goes, 6 million. Every time I said 2,000, he went 7 million.
You're like, so, this is going the wrong direction.
This is not working.
Did he know who you were? Were you talking directly?
No,
or
I emailed him from my Florida State email.
Yeah.
Or whatever that I, for some reason, still have.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just kind of gave up on it. And then we got papa.co 4 years later.
But so what year is this?
2020. And then the papa.com never went down, and he stopped responding. We hired brokers and he just stopped responding. I don't know what his goal was. We started offering like some real money, not what nearly what he asked. And so when we got .co though, it was terrible for us because now people would just naturally go to .com and .com was a dead website. So they thought our website was dead or down and they moved on. And so it actually hurt us more than we thought. However, the guy's like, oh shit, they bought papa.co. I'm never going to sell it to papa.com because they're, you know, the Pope didn't buy it. Papa John's didn't buy it. Who am I going to sell this to? It's only one other Papa that could do it. So he lowered his price to something incredibly low compared to where it was. And I bought it now on a website, like buy now button.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was so happy. And it was like such a cool moment. And it was...
When was this?
Realistic, you know, relatively fair pricing. This is like 6 months ago.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So now we've redone the website. And now it's funny because I was proud of myself for having the worst website in the history of digital health platforms and like consumer friendly tech companies, terrible website. And now we finally have like a real,
why were you proud
well
of that?
Designed. Well, because our growth was so significant.
Okay. Yeah. Like it doesn't matter.
I was proud because we were able to do what we did with something so rudimentary. And I was just excited and I'm seeing the payoff of what happens when you put some dollars into it.
That's awesome. So, Papa.com.
Papa.com. PAPA.com.
Awesome. Anything we didn't hit?
I think that's it. No, it's been a good hangout. I'm on the infamous podcast. So.
It's been wild. We talked about this even, I guess it started when we were down in Florida. I was doing it, but I'm not doing interviews really when we talked about it.
Whatever. I remember you told me you don't know if your audience is going to care about me. And I said, well, I'm pretty funny. I think I'm kind of entertaining, but then they're like, I don't know.
We'll see. Yeah. I'll let you know on the website analytics if people care or not.
Yeah. My mom will watch it.
That's all we need. No, I think this is awesome. I appreciate you going. I mean, your business is obviously fascinating. How much you've been able to grow. It's incredible to me how you've been able to manage to pull health plans and individuals, college kids, and now, you know, broader group as well as senior citizens all into one.
It's been really, really cool. Now I'm hearing people saying like, oh, we could be like the Papa of, like in health tech, in senior care for sure. And the silver economy, as some people call it.
Silver economy.
Which I hear some people are offended by that, but older people don't care that much.
That generation, yeah.
Exactly. They don't give a shit.
They're used to calling each other like very, very slanderous words.
They invented, you know, just don't call me late to dinner.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Any individual story just before we wrap on something you're proud of with the business, an outcome or a person?
Yeah, I mean, we've been growing 200-300% year over year. Our business model is great. We're helping people. I mean, we saved literally people's lives. This year, we'll do 1.5 million hours of companionship,
wow,
which I like to say it's equivalent to 114 years of human connection. And we just continue to grow. And honestly, we're building a good culture. I think everyone at Papa likes Papa. But if you don't, you know, Slack me, open Slack policy. But, you know, in our business, culture matters even more because we literally provide companionship as a platform. And so if we can't be good companions internally, like, I don't even know what we're doing.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Thanks for tweeting at me.
Yeah.
We've come a long way.
Twitter's helpful.
So that'll do it for the 22nd episode of Cartoon Avatars. Thanks to Zach Weinberg for joining. Thank you to Sean McGuire for jumping into the ring, as well as Andrew Parker for coming on. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Next week, we'll be back with the 23rd episode. It's with a guest I've wanted to have on for a while, and so it should be a really interesting conversation. And so look forward to everyone hearing that. Have a good weekend, all.